From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscowane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Women in Washington's Power Circles, we talk with novelist Patricia O'Brien about the women who inhabit the real Washington, D.C., and the women she imagined in her new novel, The Ladies' Lunch. O'Brien was a reporter for 20 years before she quit to become press secretary for Michael Dukakis's 1988 presidential campaign. Also, singer-songwriter Iris Dement. She's an Arkansas native, the youngest of 14 children. Now she draws on that background for her music. Dement's second and latest album is My Life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Supporters of the crime bill are ready to gamble that they've got the votes they need to open debate on the legislation. Leaders have to first pass a measure governing how the bill is discussed. If that fails, the crime bill cannot be debated. Democrat Charles Schumer of New York says he's not certain he's got all the votes he needs to pass the debate rule. He's hoping to pick up extra votes tomorrow. The Senate has taken its first vote on health care reform. An amendment by North Carolina Republican Jesse Helms to delay debate for a year has been rejected. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Helms tried to amend another bill to suspend action on health reform. The Senate is voting on pending legislation today in advance of another 4 hours of debate on health care. Majority Leader George Mitchell cast the vote as a test of the willingness of senators to confront the issue. The vote, 55-45, was straight down party lines with the exception of Ben Nighthorse Campbell, a Democrat of Colorado. Campbell voted with Republicans to put off the debate, an indication that he may be a swing vote on the final bill. Surprisingly, another Democrat who traditionally votes with Republicans, Richard Shelby of Alabama, voted with Democrats to reject the Helms Amendment. Shelby's been more candid than most opponents about his willingness to block final legislation that he sees as too reliant on government regulation. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Officials in Rwanda fear another mass wave of refugees will leave the country for Zaire. Southwest Rwanda is controlled by French soldiers, but they're supposed to be replaced soon by United Nations multinational force. The BBC's Jane Stanley visited the French-patrolled area.
"When the French go, we go," sprang emphatically to the lips of most Rwandans I met. They said they had no faith in the UN's ability to protect them once the French withdrawal was complete. "What did the UN do when the civil war broke out in April?" many said angrily. "They left us Rwandans here to die." At the bridge, which serves as a checkpoint between Rwanda proper and the French zone near the town of Butare, UN forces, RPF troops and French soldiers jointly escorted 35 people who did want to go home. But they were the tiny minority. People sit by the roadside cooking around campfires with their belongings bundled up around them. Spirits are low and tensions high as they talk about what many who believe the former government's propaganda fear is inevitable. They must flee or lose their lives in revenge killings.
Jane Stanley reporting. Meanwhile, a new threat has emerged near the refugee camps in Zaire. A volcano has erupted near Goma, spewing ash and dust. There's been no immediate gush of lava. The volcano erupts periodically. The last killer blast was in 1977. 1,000 people died. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 10 points at 3766. This is NPR. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan is having differences with members of Congress over the nation's economic policy. A House panel is trying to convince him that the central bank is too eager to raise interest rates. They say the Fed's information can be unreliable or biased. But Greenspan doesn't agree. He says improvement in the data that he uses to make a decision is good, but he says it is doubtful that any change would alter past or future Federal Reserve decisions. The French government has jailed another 6 people in its effort against extremist Islamic activists. French police are stopping thousands of people every night and checking their identity papers. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The Interior Ministry said the 6 Algerians, who were interned in a compound northeast of Paris, were associated with a terrorist group and represented a threat to public security. 17 other Algerians have been detained in the same compound since last week. following the murder of five Frenchmen in Algeria. Islamic militants in Algeria have threatened to carry out reprisals in France if the government doesn't release the detainees. In response, police have staged massive dragnet operations, checking the identity papers of some 10,000 people in the past few days. The Interior Minister said these were fishing expeditions that were not directly linked to any network of Islamic militants in France. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The new Whitewater Independent Council is promising to be fair, professional, and thorough. Kenneth Starr made that pledge today in Arkansas. He says he'll build on the work of outgoing counsel Robert Fisk. The probe is focusing on President Clinton's business affairs in Arkansas, including his ties to a failed Arkansas real estate deal. Democrats are charging the new prosecutor is too partisan. Starr is a Republican who served as President Bush's Solicitor General. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. In yesterday's Washington Post, Budget Director-designate Alice Rivlin revealed that in the 70s, she was part of the Smart Women's Club, a small group of high-powered Washington women who met regularly for dinner to talk about policy issues. This kind of informal women's network is becoming more common in Washington as women try to chip away at the old boys' club that's ruled the Capitol since its beginning. One of these women is Patricia O'Brien. She was a journalist for 20 years, worked as Michael Dukakis's press secretary during the 1988 presidential campaign, and then turned to fiction. Her first novel was The Candidate's Wife. Her new book, The Ladies' Lunch, is about a group of five Washington women who meet every month for lunch and gossip. When the novel opens, one of the women in the group has just mysteriously drowned in the Potomac River. O'Brien told me that she's been part of a ladies' lunch for many years, and it's one of the best parts of living in Washington.
I think that about 10, 15 years ago, certainly among the women I know, we realized that there was something missing as we were all working very hard to succeed professionally, and that was that sense of actually being able to relax with women. And women who do enjoy the company of women are finding that to meet on a regular basis, you, without even realizing it, you are both having the nurturance of personal friendship, and also you are having the kind of classic networking opportunities that it used to be only men had.
So you're part of an official ladies' lunch?
Yeah, I am.
Mm-hmm. Who's in your group?
Well, Leslie Stahl formed our group about 15 or 16 years ago, 1978 actually. And there were just a few of us in the original group. And let's see, they included Nancy Dutton, who is a lawyer here in town, and Linda Wertheimer, who certainly your audience probably knows, with all things considered, and Cokie Roberts, and Ann Charnley, and that was our original, and Dottie Lynch. That was our original group, and we just basically wanted a place where you could relax. We were all very busy professionals. I was working as a reporter here in Washington. And we sort of decided initially what we were going to do is not talk about anything serious. We were going to basically gossip and enjoy ourselves and laugh and relax.
And was it hard to not talk about politics?
Well, you know, as the years go on, of course, what we really found that we had was something quite valuable over time because it developed such texture. You know, it wasn't just work and it wasn't just getting together. If you know people over a long period of time, you go through deaths with them, you go through divorces, you go through illness, you go through good times, you find ways to help each other, and you begin realizing that what you've been part of is something extremely special.
Did you have a name for this group? I mean, do you call yourselves the Ladies' Lunch?
We called ourselves the Ladies' Lunch, that's right. I used the title. And I will hasten to say, and it's been vetted by my fellow real-life ladies' lunchers, my book is not at all about the women that are my real-life friends. But I wanted to take the idea of women coming together and getting to know each other over time. And just briefly, in my novel, in The Ladies' Lunch, they all come together, and one of this group mysteriously dies, and it becomes the catalyst for them to discover more about themselves and their friendships, and there's an element of mystery in there. So this is a ladies' lunch of very high-powered women who the reader begins to see much of the personal side of them that you don't normally see.
Well, one of the women's husbands, Justin Maccabee, is, without giving away too much of the plot, is involved in the story. And the way you describe him, there's a certain phrase that I thought was pretty interesting. You write, he always looked filled with secrets. People try to look that way in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because I think in Washington, a lot of people want to be seen as very important. And importance and power in Washington always has something of an amorphous nature to it. For one thing, it doesn't last. Every group that comes in thinks it's going to, but it doesn't. It seems just written stone, you know, and then come the next election and the voters may decide it isn't. And people who had extremely important positions or felt they were very key players are suddenly, in a sense, out on the street. And for the really good people who come to this town, they never lose sight of that. They never forget that it's their job that's important, not themselves. But it's a town where a lot of games are played. And people who are perceived as having power do, I think, at least some of them on occasion, have a tendency to try to look filled with a great deal of power and, of course, all those secrets that nobody else knows.
So how does someone cash in on that?
You mean in terms of...
if you have this powerful secret.
Power has such cachet in this town, and it's a social ticket. Some of these are things that people have known for years about Washington, but you almost have to walk through the set to realize how true it is. It increases importance, and Washington does tend, with all of what is really important that does happen here, Washington does tend to turn into itself. Mm-hmm. There is a small town sort of incestuous sense here. There aren't that many ways people earn their living in Washington. You're a lawyer. You work for the government. You're a journalist. Well, there you are. You count the people at the bus stops in the morning or going by in the taxi cabs, and that's what they do.
What do you think about the influence that the First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton has had on the atmosphere inside of Washington? And she's certainly much more activist and much more visible, probably the most visible First Lady.
Mm-hmm.
How do you evaluate what effect she's had on that culture?
Well, inside Washington, I think she has drawn some tremendously savage attacks. I happen to be a strong admirer of Hillary Clinton's, and I think she's remaking a role in a fascinating way, which will be interesting to look back on and see how the changes were taking place. But I think she's taken some real hits, and it's fascinating because I think that that the hostile reactions, this town still has trouble with what one might describe as an uppity woman, huh. A woman who doesn't stay in the place that it's been decided that is hers. Here she comes in, First Lady. Now, the First Lady is supposed to be primarily decorative, sort of a moral presence, she can be a metaphor, a sieve of a lifestyle. She can be all of what Jackie Kennedy represented, which was new life and change in the White House, and beauty and glamour and many good things. But with the exception of Eleanor Roosevelt, who also took huge hits, most of the first ladies since then have pretty much stuck to their roles, and when they haven't, they've been criticized.
You know, it's interesting, and you use the word uppity woman,
uh-huh.
that which has is a pretty powerful description. And it's curious to me, in a town that is filled with quote, professional people. I mean, people, lawyers and people that understand and wield a fair amount of power. Why a powerful woman is still considered a threat? I don't completely understand that.
Well, you know, I've puzzled and puzzled over that, and I have one way of trying to describe it. I take a look at someone like Hillary Clinton or women who also seem to elicit this resistance. And if you think about it, what she demonstrates or what she seems to represent is an absence of need. And I think that absence of need really throws a lot of people off when it's a woman. When there is a self-containment, it makes people nervous. Certainly in the situation of a woman who would be there as first lady. So this absence of need, I think, oftentimes is a silent trigger for hostility toward the uppity women of the world.
Well, it also looks as if she's trying to redefine herself as well, and I don't mean to be too trite here, but even her changing hairstyles seems to be a way of her looking for a picture of who she should be as first lady. Would you agree with that?
I think there is something to that. I think that the sort of shaping and reshaping of image of how do you appear? Yeah, I think there's certainly that aspect of it. I think women have been we have really through our lives had a very strong conscious sense of how our appearance affects how we are viewed and whether or not we are liked or admired. So I think that Hillary Clinton, as well as the rest of us, may have at times difficulty getting rid of that self-conscious. How do they see me?
Right.
How do I look? So that could be certainly behind the changing hairstyles.
Well, speaking of hairstyles, I'm curious, too, about the kind of wardrobe it appears that women who live inside the Beltway wear, whether they're journalists or members of Congress. And I guess I don't have one of these. It's one of these red suits that people seem to have.
You're going to tell us we're frumpy.
No. I'm not even sure it's even frumpy, but it's when there's I guess if I'm watching CNN or something, there's a picture of Congress or there's an important vote or the president is speaking there and the camera pans the members of Congress, the women are all wearing these red suits. Do you know why?
I think that women back 10 years or so ago became very savvy about what got attention. During the Reagan administration is where I think it began. He began calling on women when they were dressed in bright colors. So the reporters who would show up for the press conferences would wear red is probably the best color that shows up in a sea of gray and brown. And so they would wear bright colors.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest on Fresh Air is Patricia O'Brien, and she's a journalist and the author of several novels. Her latest one is called The Lady's Lunch. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist and novelist Patricia O'Brien is my guest. Her new book is called The Lady's Lunch. Let me just backtrack, if I can. And you were a journalist, a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, and I assume worked at other papers as well. And you were also hired to be Michael Dukakis's press secretary for his 88 presidential campaign. How did you get that job?
I had been covering both Gary Hart and Jerry Ferraro in the 1984 presidential campaign, and during the course of the year, I met John Sasso, who later was campaign manager for Michael Dukakis, and out of the blue in '87, I had a call And they asked me, would I be interested in, my memory of the first line was, "Hello, Pat, how are you? Would you be interested in a career change?"
Hmm.
And at that time, I had been a reporter for 20 years, and I was interested in a career change. It had not been, I was not thinking about going into politics. But when the job was offered and the questions were posed, it was intriguing. I think I will always have one element of what being a journalist is all about, and that's curiosity. And I thought that I'd always wondered what went on the other side.
Well, did you feel that you were going over to the other side?
I felt I was seeing another aspect of the way the whole process of politics and government works in this country. And it was a really valuable experience in seeing both sides of the process, both after having spent time as a reporter and then being on the other side and seeing how difficult it can be to organize and plan a campaign that stays in the going in the direction that you want it to go. And I have a great deal of respect for the people who work very hard in politics, and there are some that I have not much more than contempt for. So it's the range, but the same is true in journalism.
Well, what would you say journalism then, or journalists, look like from the other side? And obviously, you were there to shape, I guess, the kind of coverage that you wanted your candidate to have.
I found, actually, on balance, that the reporters and journalists I had respected before I went to work for Michael Dukakis were the same ones that I liked and respected afterward. I did find that there were a number of reporters who essentially didn't believe anything. I'll never forget the first time I was telling a reporter something that the governor had done and looked up after having given this reporter the information and saw this complete look of disbelief as if, no, that's not true. And I said, "You don't believe me?" And there was this very skeptical response, and that was startling. It was so absolutely, fundamentally accurate, and yet I found myself as a representative for a politician. Initially, the sort of the thrust of journalism has become, they're all lying first, and then if they work really hard to convince us, we will allow grudgingly that maybe some of them are telling the truth. And I think that's bad for journalism.
Do you think the press gave Michael Dukakis a fair shake?
I think Michael Dukakis, in the long run, was not a man who had wanted enough to be president from the beginning. And he's a terrific person, and I will always respect him. But I think to run for president takes a deep, deep hunger and commitment and focus. And in many ways, and this is a positive thing about him, that was not there. He had his whole life that he was thinking about, and in a sense, things moved on so rapidly. And when he became the nominee, or moved towards, and that when the engine started rolling, it was a surprise to him.
When you were a press secretary for Michael Dukakis during his presidential campaign, I assume that you knew about Kitty Dukakis and her problems with alcohol, did you?
I was called into Kitty's office. Let's see if I can go back. Now I've got to reconstruct. Yes is the short answer. And if you may recall, we had a major release of the information. I had been hearing from some reporters that there had been some period of time before I ever came to Boston Work Forum where Kitty had disappeared off the screen, and they had said she was somewhere, but they didn't believe it. And there were all sorts of rumors going around, and it bothered me. I was in this new job, so I went in to see Mrs. Dukakis, and I said, we had a nice talk getting to know her, and then I said, is there anything I don't know that I should know? And she said, yes. So she told me. And I said, this can't be kept secret. This has to be revealed, because it will be found out. This is something that frequently people don't realize when they're in politics. And she agreed with me. So we had a meeting with the governor and John Sasso, and eventually worked out the format at which the way it would be done. And so I had them, she appeared with her husband at a morning meeting where she was going to tell the story of her addiction. And this was when she was addicted to pills, as you might recall, and she had gone to Hazleton, the treatment center, and that's where she had mysteriously disappeared to before he ran for president. So while she was giving the speech, I sat in my office with half-hour segments through the entire day and night and called every news operation and said, you're going to want a half hour with Kitty Dukakis today.
Hmm.
And some of them said, nah. but they did. And so that was a major, getting that story out in a major way was very important to me.
Let me ask you about something else that Maggie Stedman, the journalist in your novel, deals with, or is grappling with. She says she violated a code in journalism, and I got the feeling that the code that she felt she violated, and this is because she felt so bad about having written something about a senator, and then actually had outed him, and then he killed himself. And it seemed like the code that she violated had to do with getting emotional about a story. Is that what you meant by the code?
Yes, in that sense, what it really... It, in a way, becoming too thoughtful about something. There are certain barriers up for reporters. And again, when I am glad to see people begin to challenge them, and they are self-justifying barriers. The job isn't easy. What you are there for is to give people the news, to tell them what is happening, to essentially give them heads up on stuff. It's to let them know what's been done to their money, what's all of the various aspects of what a free press is all about in this country. When there are either ethically or morally ambiguous situations, I think that there is a strong tendency in the whole business of journalism to try to deny the ambiguities. And if you get bogged down in the ambiguities, it makes everybody nervous.
So for journalists then who are trying to deal with some of these ambiguous situations, you're saying what they do is report them as if they are fact when in fact they're not. Is that what you mean?
No. What I mean is, in much of what you do, if you overthink it, I've had an editor once say to me, don't deep think this, just do your job.
And by that meaning, don't consider some of these ambiguous situations.
Mm-hmm. It makes for a softer lead.
And were you able to do that?
No, which is why really after 20 years I'd had enough. The business was very good to me and for me, and I had some wonderful experiences, and I'm really glad that I've had that career. But there was a point at which I thought I really want to go on.
Well, I thank you very much, Patricia O'Brien, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Patricia O'Brien's new novel is called The Lady's Lunch. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Singer-songwriter Iris DeMent has been called a backwoods Emily Dickinson. Her music has been described as simple, honest, heartfelt country music. Coming up, we meet Iris DeMent. Her new and second album, My Life, reflects on her upbringing, one of 14 children in a Pentecostal family. You may have heard one of her songs in the recent film, Little Buddha. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The federal government is expected to move swiftly to head off any possibility of another mass exodus of migrants from Cuba. George Guetta reports.
The centerpiece of the U.S. plan would be an effort to deter the outward movement of boats from Florida to pick up would-be emigres. Officials say President Clinton would invoke emergency powers authorizing the confiscation of vessels and the imposition of fines to prevent exiles from picking up their Cuban brethren. President Fidel Castro alarmed official Washington last week after he raised the possibility of a repeat of the Mariel boat lift of 1980. At the time, 125,000 Cubans came to the United States over a five-month period. Politically, Mariel was a disaster for President Carter. It contributed to his 1980 election defeat. South Florida exile leaders say they have no intention of encouraging a repeat of Mariel, and U.S. officials find those statements reassuring. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
The United Nations is warning of possible airstrikes in Bosnia. The UN peacekeeping commander there says Bosnian government troops and Bosnian Serbs are trading gunfire. General Michael Rose says both sides are violating the ban on heavy weapons around Sarajevo. They're trying to control a highway north of the capital that links the city with Olovo, a central Bosnian town. The road is a key military supply route during bad winter weather. Public health officials are warning that a massive tuberculosis epidemic is likely as AIDS spreads through Asia. Joe Neal reports from the International AIDS Conference in Yokohama, Japan.
The World Health Organization says that more than 2.5 million people are already infected with the AIDS virus in Asia. Now, preliminary studies suggest that as many as half will contract tuberculosis at some point during their disease. WHO spokesman Craig Clout says that a TB epidemic in Asia could dwarf what's already been seen in sub-Saharan Africa. Officials are concerned that medical facilities in Asia could be overwhelmed by the combined epidemics. By the year 2000, the number of people infected with HIV in Asia could quadruple to 10 million. For National Public Radio, I'm Joe Neal in Yokohama.
Wildfire troubles have increased in Idaho. A blistering wildfire is rushing through the Payette National Forest. Thousands of trees have been consumed. The U.S. Forest Service has closed off a giant area, about 950 square miles. Fire crews are struggling to contain the blaze. Meanwhile, firefighters in Washington State are progressing well. They expect to contain the very large Tyee Creek fire today. That has burned more than 120,000 acres. A blaze in California's Klamath National Forest has jumped containment lines. Fire officials say it won't be recontained until Sunday. Stock prices ended higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials added 11 points to end the day at 3,766. This is NPR. Argentine President Carlos Menem says Iran's ambassador to his country should be expelled. An Argentine judge has issued arrest warrants for four absent Iranian diplomats in connection with a recent bombing of a Jewish community center. Nearly 100 people were killed. Menem told a radio interviewer the least that could be called for was the ambassador's departure. The White House is barring a number of imports from Taiwan because of that nation's trade in products made from endangered tigers and rhinos. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The sanctions against Taiwan mark the first trade measures to protect endangered species ever taken under a 16-year-old U.S. law called the Pelley Amendment to the Fishermen's Protective Act. The Clinton administration first warned Taiwan in April it would impose sanctions on up to $25 million of products from the tiny Southeast Asian country because it violated an international treaty barring trade in endangered wildlife species. The ban, which takes effect August 19th, includes imports of products made from reptile leather, jewelry from shells and bones, live goldfish and tropical fish, bird feathers, and edible frog legs. The White House says affected imports, products made from wildlife, are not limited to that list. The sanctions will stay in effect until the president lifts them. Tigers and rhinos have been hunted to near extinction for body parts that are used in traditional Oriental medicines and remedies. Taiwan said today that it regretted the U.S. decision to impose the sanctions and added that the island was increasing measures to protect wildlife. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A new study says about 1% of the smog hanging over Los Angeles is tobacco smoke. Scientists at the California Institute of Technology say the L.A. air is made up of tiny particles from lots of different sources. They link only 1% of the visible pollution to cigarette smoke. That's about the same amount that's caused by pots of roofing tar and automobile brake linings and tires as they wear out. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When Iris DeMent's first CD, Infamous Angel, came out in 1992, folk singer John Prine wrote in the liner notes, "Iris DeMent's songs talk about isolated memories of life, love, and living. Iris has a voice I like a whole lot, like one you've heard before, but not really." Iris DeMent first started performing in public in the mid-'80s, and while singers like Prine and Nancy Griffith have sung her praises, she's still relatively unknown. Mostly, she gets airplay on alternative and public radio stations. But that could change. She has a new CD called My Life and a busy touring schedule. One of the subjects she sings about is her large family. She was born in Arkansas and grew up in California, the youngest of 14 children. Before we meet Iris DeMent, let's begin with the title song of her new album, My Life.
Don't count for nothing when I look at this world. I feel so small, and my life, it's only a season, a passing September.
Songs are intensely personal, it seems to me. And of course, there's the inevitable question about how autobiographical your songs are, how much you write directly or even indirectly from your own life.
I think that I hope I'm not making a mistake to say this, but I think that it's true to say that if I don't write directly from my own life, I always write indirectly from my own life. I have a lot of songs that are very much about me, but I think whenever I write, I have to find something in my own life that I can identify with in order to write a song. So, yeah, there's always a chunk of me.
Did you ever take singing lessons?
No, I didn't.
So the voice that we hear on I guess you can't say albums anymore, that we hear on CDs, that's the voice you were born with?
I guess so. I didn't go purchase a different one along the way.
Well, I didn't know whether you've changed it or played with it or developed it yourself.
Well, I guess the way I should answer that is I'm told, at least, you know, that I could always sing, and that probably is true because my family just seems like we could sing. I mean, as far as, you know, having a decent voice and an ability to carry a tune, it seemed to come pretty natural to all of us. But certainly I developed my own style along the way and tried to get better at singing. I listened to a lot of records, and when I found somebody that I really loved, I'll just come out and tell you, I spent good chunks of time trying to sing just like them.
Who would these people be, though?
Well, probably starters was Loretta Lynn, okay. But even probably just subconsciously by singing along to her records when I was very young, and ooh, I really like that. And you just imitate it. You do that with everything in your life. Kids imitate their parents. That's how we grow up, know what to do. So for me, it was with artists, you know. I can remember probably about 10 years old working really hard to sing just like Aretha Franklin. I just adored her, so, you know, I wanted to be her. And I've continued to do that. I've done it with a lot of people. And, you know, my most recent one, I've broken myself of that since I, you know, started writing. I realized I needed to find my own style and my own way of doing things. But the most recent one was Lefty Frizzell. I just heard him and fell in love with his voice. And so, you know, I'm sure that what I do is a mix of all those things. It's partly what I was born with, and it's partly what's inspired me along the way.
Well, Iris, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a very short break. And my guest on Fresh Air is Iris Dement. She's a singer-songwriter. She has a new album out called My Life. We'll be back in just 30 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Singer-songwriter Iris Dement is my guest. I want to play a song from your new album, My Life, and this song is called No Time to Cry, and it's about your father who died 2 years ago, and it was about his death. And before we play that song, first of all, how did he die?
My father was 82 years old when he died, and my dad had had a stroke about 6 years before that, I guess it was. And he never fully recovered from that stroke. And this is really embarrassing to say, but I don't know all the medical explanations for how my dad died. I know that his heart started getting weak, and he started losing circulation in his leg. And then just one thing led to another, and then within a couple of weeks, his heart just wasn't pumping the blood right, the doctor said. And so he just gradually died. And so I guess you say his heart gave out on him. Hmm.
Well, let's play No Time to Cry from your new album.
My father died a year ago today. Rooster started crowing when they carried Dad away. There beside my mother in the living room I stood, with my brothers and my sisters knowing Dad was gone for good. Well, I stayed at home just long enough to lay him in the ground, and then I caught a plane to do a show up north in Detroit town, because I'm older now. I've got no time to cry. I've got no time to look back. I've got no time to see the pieces of my heart that have been ripped away from me. And if the feeling starts to come in, I've learned to stop and fight.
Well, in your liner notes to your new album, you write about your father and about his fiddle, and he played as a young man, but put his fiddle away, it seems the way you write, because of religion.
Uh-huh.
Is that true?
Well, I'm still not all that certain about what exactly happened. I know that the church, way back in those days, certainly had an attitude about fiddles and banjos and things like that, because those were the instruments that were used at dance halls. And the churches that I grew up in didn't want to affiliate themselves with those sorts of things.
And that was the Pentecostal church?
Yes. Okay. So I, in spite of what my mother says, you know, my mom told me later that it wasn't really so much that, but that my dad associated with his past life. And I'm sure that that's partly true, but I also think that the church associated those instruments with a life that they didn't approve of.
Do you know much about your dad's past life, to use your words?
I grew up in Southern California, and my first memories of my dad were there. My dad was a janitor and at this place, and it was Southern California in a housing tract. But I always knew that there was something different about my dad and my family, for that matter. I was always aware that there was just something about him that didn't seem like the neighborhood dads. So I've always, from the time I was young, been collecting little pieces of information about him to just understand things a little better. And so I should explain maybe that my dad was born and raised on an island in Arkansas. I have pictures of this house, actually, that my dad grew up in, and it's like this wooden frame shack. I mean, you can practically look through the pieces of wood. In fact, some of my brothers remember waking up with snow on their legs, you know. So my dad's world that he grew up in was totally different from mine. He lived there till he was 50-something years old, I believe, maybe some right around in there. And his family, his brothers and sisters, when they grew up, they built houses out there and raised their kids. So my dad grew up in this very isolated world that basically was just his family. I also, you know, as a kid, I was always intrigued that they rode around on horses and buggies and things like that, and I'd hear about this stuff. I remember hearing my brothers talk about that, you know, going to church. Well, my mom, too, going to church on the buggy.
Well, he clearly, your father clearly was a religious man, and religion was very important to him. Did he raise you and your 13 brothers and sisters with religion?
Yes. well, actually, I can't speak for my oldest ones. I think that my dad had already had several of the kids before he got religion. In fact, I need to talk to my mother, but it might have been, you know, 4 or 5 kids, actually, before he really got religion in the big way.
Meaning being saved.
Yeah, being saved and completely changing your life around. So from my perspective, I say yes to that. I don't know about some of the older kids. I'd have to ask them. But during the time that I was growing up, by all means, we were very religious and went to church quite a lot and got a lot of religion in the house as well. So, my dad and my mother both very much raised us extremely religiously.
And the music in the house was what, gospel music?
My parents let us buy records and let us listen to the radio music that wasn't gospel music. They called it worldly music.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to listen to that music, but the music that we sang in the house and worked on in the house was gospel music. My family was sort of like the music family in the church, so there was a lot of preparing, like for specials, what they call for church. Like my sisters would work up specials and different groups. So there was always a lot of gospel music.
Would you describe yourself as a religious person? I mean, do you go to Pentecostal church?
I quit going to church when I was 16, about 16 years that old, I guess it was. I feel like I'm religious, but I'm not. I haven't found a book of religion that I feel all the way comfortable with, and I haven't found a church that I feel comfortable with. I went to Unitarian Church for a while, and I like a lot of their ideas and the things they say, but I just think they could improve on their music programs a little. It's a little boring in my book. So to me, church isn't complete without some really good music.
Well, speaking of music, you have an interesting song, and I don't know whether this reflects the state of your faith. The song is called Let the Mystery Be, and it's on your first album, Infamous Angel. Does that reflect where you're at?
Yeah, pretty much. That's how I think about those things.
Well, let's play Let the Mystery Be, and this is performed by our guest on Fresh Air today, Iris DeMent.
Everybody is wondering what and where they all came from. Everybody is worrying about where they're gonna go when the whole thing's done. But no one knows for certain, and so it's all the same to me. I think I'll just let the mystery be. Some say once gone, you're gone forever, and some say you're gonna come back. Some say you rest in the arms of the Savior if in sinful ways you lack. Some say that they're coming back in a garden, bunch of carrots and little sweet peas. I think I'll just let the mystery be.
That's singer-songwriter Iris DeMent singing Let the Mystery Be from her album Infamous Angel. More from Iris DeMent in 1 minute. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about all things considered today. Noah, what stories do you have for us?
Hi, Marty. The health care debate is ongoing in the U.S. Senate. Elizabeth Arnold has that report from Capitol Hill. Mara Liasson tells us how all this is being received by the Clinton White House. I will talk with a BBC reporter in Pale. In that part of Bosnia that's controlled by the Serbs, he says the Belgrade government does appear to have cut off supplies to the Bosnian Serbs. It's too soon to tell if gasoline, crucial for the war effort, will be affected. Also, new estimates that the number of people actually linked up by computer to the Internet may be vastly overstated. And Teller of Penn & Teller has a remembrance of a carnival sideshow.
Noah, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We're back with singer-songwriter Iris DeMent. She has a new CD called My Life. We heard earlier about her father, who died a few years ago. She told me her mother also has been a big influence on her life and music.
She loves music. I mean, more than just singing well. My mom just has a great passion for music and has, apparently, since she was very young. Recently she gave me this little book of like school pieces of paper. My mom's 76, so this was like when she was 13, 14, of songs she'd been collecting from the time she was very young, where these old songs that she'd write down on a piece of paper, and she tied the book together, little shoestrings and stuff. So my mom's had a great passion for music for a long time.
Well, there's a song on Infamous Angel called Mama's Opry. Could you tell us the story behind that?
Well, When I guess I'd been writing for maybe a couple of years, and well, not quite that long, I'm not sure exactly, but it was pretty early on, and I wanted to write a song for my mother. And so I started thinking about, you know, what was the thing about my mother that was most significant to me, or said the most to me about her, and that I settled on my mind that that was her love for music. And so I just told her story, really, in that song. My mother, when she was young, she used to listen to the Carter Family and Jimmy Rogers and those old Grand Ole Opry radio shows. And I remembered when I was very young, I must have been about five, I can remember singing along. My mother and I were singing along to a Loretta Lynn gospel record. And my mom said something about this place called the Grand Ole Opry and that she'd wanted to go off and sing there. And that stuck with me. And when I was writing that song that day, I began to remember that and remember that she'd sort of mentioned that off and on a number of times while I was growing up. And so that song's just about that dream that she had.
Well, let's listen to Mama's Opry, and that's performed by our guest today on Fresh Air, Iris DeMent.
Twenty or more, they're on an old wooden floor, dancing to a country sound. your show and she would sing along. And I'll never forget her face when she revealed to me that she dreamed about singing at the Grand Old Opry.
You know what I find unusual, and I can't decide if it's a reflection on me or this culture or on you, but you do sing about how you love your parents in such a direct and honest way. And that's, I think, fairly unusual for someone in their mid-30s to sing and say those words. And I don't know if that's unusual for you.
You know, that's true what you say. You don't often hear that, and I don't know why that is. I think a lot of people make the mistake, listening to my music, of thinking that I came from this perfect background and my parents are perfect, wonderful people and we had this perfect family. And that's not the case at all. My family had a lot of problems. There was a lot of struggles. There was a lot of low points. And my parents did not have this perfect marriage and we weren't the perfect family. My parents had a lot of faults. But there was some quality to my parents that overrode all of those things. And I think, you know, I just grew up always knowing that my parents loved us a lot. And in spite of all the trouble, we were going to come first. The kids in the family were first. And as a group, we were the priority. And I think as I get older, I can look back and see just all these little things that just showed a tremendous amount of loyalty and just different qualities. And so I don't know, you know, it's not a matter of being perfect, but I just they made a huge print on me, and I feel a tremendous amount of affection for them.
Singer-songwriter Iris Dement, her new album is My Life. Let's close with Sweet is the Melody.
Sweet is the melody, so hard to come by. It's so hard make every note bind just right. You lay down the hours and leave not one trace, but a tune for the dancing is there in its place. Well, the dance floors for gliding and not jumping over ponies, where boots and gold bracelets come and meet as they should. It's for celebrating a Friday.
Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landrell. Engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as we draw nearer to a baseball strike, we discuss the economics of the game with University of Chicago economist Alan Sanderson, an expert on the business side of baseball. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join us on the next Fresh Air.